Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Today is Tuesday, April 28th, 2015. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government, opening a public hearing on House Bill 5035, Department of Revenue. Mr. Borden.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair and members of the subcommittee. Before you is the Department of Revenue, House Bill 5034. Today, the agency begins their phase two hearing with a review of their policy option packages, substantive or policy bills that have the potential to impact their budget, and then they will go through their reduction options. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Mr. Buchholz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
For the record, Jim Buchholz, Director of your Department of Revenue, and with me today is Chris Kautz, our deputy. And today, I'm going to drive the technology, and Chris is going to drive the discussion. So I'll give it a turn.
Excellent. Have at it.
Great. Good afternoon, Chair Steiner, Hayward, and members of the committee. I am Chris Kautz. I'm the Deputy Director at the Oregon Department of Revenue. And as John already indicated, my overview will include our policy option packages, our 10% reduction options, as well as bills with fiscal impacts. So we will go through that information today. If you have any questions, please let me know along the way.
Thank you.
So with that, thank you. So this first slide is an overview of the seven policy option packages that are in the governor's budget for the Oregon Department of Revenue. I will be going through each one of these in more detail for you. Some of the information you already saw in phase one, I will reiterate it as a build up to why we are requesting the funds. There is the last two we didn't talk specifically about, I don't think, in phase one, the 911 tax and then governor's budget reductions weren't specifically discussed, and so I will also be going over those as well. These right here are for the operational costs, specifically for core systems replacement and the property valuation system. They do not include debt service or issuance costs or any of the bond proceeds in there. Those are operational costs only, and that's what I will be discussing as we go through the policy option packages today. So with that, so first off is our core system replacement policy option package. Mr. Smith included the same slide that you saw in his presentation in phase one. Just a reminder of both why we are doing it, to avoid risk and improve performance, but then the timeline that we've had, that has been discussed many times here with us being currently in rollout two for personal income tax, moving to rollout three all of next year, and then beginning rollout four as part of the 2015-17 biennium. So it will cover costs across all of those rollouts. The project, I will remind you, is a total of $81 million, $65 million in implementation costs, and then $9 million in both interest and issuance costs, and $7 million was incurred prior to implementing the system in the 2013-15 biennium, current biennium. Anything else? Okay. Next slide. So here are the specific costs for next biennium highlighted in the green bar there. We have $900,000 of ongoing agency general fund that's committed to the project. These are three base positions in our agency program management office, the administrator, Mr. Smith, who you've met before, a project manager, and a business analyst. The general fund component there that you see, there's two components there, $200,000 in non-bond eligible general fund services and supplies costs. So those are things that under accounting manual are not allowable for bond proceeds to pay for. Training is one of the key components in there that bond proceeds won't allow us to pay for. The $4.2 million is a combination of enterprise technology services, otherwise known as state data center costs, that we have to support the core system replacement project, as well as maintenance and support for the project going forward. The 26.
Ms. Cox, yes. Can I just ask you a quick question about that? Those costs, those ETS costs, are separate from the standard ETS assessment from BAS, right? That's a separate.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, these are specific to this project. Okay. We also have base costs that for the data center that support our ongoing operations. The $26.3 million is for the 33 positions that are dedicated to the project full-time, as well as the other costs associated with vendor payment for the software that we're receiving from Fast Enterprises, the quality assurance vendor, change leadership, those types of things. So that's what the 26.3 is for next biennium out of bond proceeds. Okay. We have talked a lot about kind of leading up into the project, but we haven't talked in this committee, at least, about some of the opportunities that we have already seen with Rollout 1 in our project. And I thought I would just highlight a few of them here. There are many more, and we will see many more benefits to the project going forward. For instance, right now, employees can see actions in real time rather than waiting for overnight batch processing. So if you make a payment on your account, it will actually show the employee then your account is either at zero or you still owe or a credit may be due depending on what's occurring with your account. Before, we would actually have to wait until the system batched that overnight before we would get corrected account information. Employees can view actual images of the correspondence that is sent out to taxpayers. So when a taxpayer calls and says, I got this letter and I need to talk to you about it, they can actually, there'll be a letter identifier on it and they can pull it up. And so both parties are looking at the same thing and having the same conversation. That's a lot of struggle that we've had in servicing taxpayers right now. And of course, you've heard a little bit about Revenue Online, which is providing self-service options for looking up account information, setting up payment plans, making payments, requesting penalty waivers or appeals. This can all be done online. They can review their correspondence. We don't have a lot of those options right now in our self service portal that we have up on our website. And then, of course, we've also talked a little bit about risk scoring of refunds to determine who needs to review what and when. The tool will allow us some analytics that are already built in, and we are very excited to see this option moving forward. So that's all I had on core system replacement, unless there are any other questions. Okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. You were talking about risk scoring on your refunds. Can you explain a little more to us about the capability of the new core system in risk scoring accounts receivable and the reiterate to us how that your what's built in and what else you may need in order to address better debt collection?
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we're going to go over that in fairly significant detail tomorrow.
Okay, that's fine.
But
I'll wait.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Yep,
okay.
Sorry.
Great. Thanks, Jim. So the next policy option package is on fraud analytics and detection. I have brought back a slide that Mr. Ross showed you when he was in here to show you the growth of the fraud attempts that we have seen inside of our organization over the last 5 years, to reiterate the fact that fraud attempts continue to grow despite our best efforts to put the business rules in place to stop those payments. There was also even the article in the Statesman Journal today that showed that Oregon, from an identity theft standpoint, is third in the nation on a per $100,000 cap a basis for those that have had their identity stolen, which of course is a big component of fraud as well. So I just wanted to bring this back to reiterate to you why it's important that we think we have the tools in place to help us ensure that taxpayers who have made their appropriate payments and are due refunds get their refunds and that somebody hasn't stolen their identity in the process.
So just doing some really fast division, it looks as if the percentage paid out for the past 2 years is about equal. It's about 3% both the last 2 years. What's your guesstimate about what that percentage might drop to with the new system? Or is that too tough to?
Madam Chair, I don't even know how I would begin to answer that, because what the new system is going to do is it's going to identify potentially fraudulent refunds that we're not identifying now, and we don't know what we don't know. So that's one of the problems that we have with pitching this to you, is we can't identify with specificity the dollars that we're letting through the door, because if we knew about them, we'd stop them.
I guess maybe I didn't ask my question really clearly. It's clear that there's a lot happening that you don't know, but you know some of it, because you said that there were 4,779 stopped in the previous year. Actually, that means the percentage is slightly lower, because I was dividing using that as the denominator instead of the total, so it's probably more like 2%, which isn't terrible. But regardless, your denominator is going to grow, but your numerator will hopefully not grow significantly as well. And so I understand it's tough to predict, but based on what other states have found, surely...
Madam Chair, it's even hard to compare with other states, because it depends on what your baseline is before you go in. Every state has a different level of sophistication in the way that they stop refunds with their legacy system.
Okay. Senator Whitson.
Yeah. Well, I think what might be useful is to put some dollar figures on the data that you do have.
In terms of the excuse me, Madam Chair, Senator.
In terms of how much, say, in 2014 you paid 159, how much was that? And you stopped 4,779, how much was that? And then each year that, I would assume you have that information.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we do, and if you look at the left-hand side, that's what we stopped. In 2014,
okay.
We stopped 8 million. And we paid out a little bit more than 100,000 or 200,000.
Okay.
Thank you.
I didn't see that. I didn't see the left-hand column.
Nor did I. So thank you for asking the question. Please.
So with this fraud analytics package, there's two components. The first component is for us to purchase an integrated data exchange via Fast Enterprises, our current vendor, to get data from Thomson Reuters, one of the big data, as they're known, big data warehouses, on personally identifiable information. So matching people, social security numbers, matching their addresses, that type of thing. And that would allow us to further filter not only for the business rules we have in place, but then to also look at the person themselves to say, are they who we think they are? And then if those are questionable, the second component would be then to send them an identity verification quiz to say, if you can answer these questions, we're pretty confident you are who you say you are. Right. So those are the two components of that package. This would be roughly $375,000 a year of general fund. It would be an ongoing expense, and this is for the 2 years for 2015-17.
So I know we've talked about this at some length, but there's one question I'm not sure I've asked, or if I have, I apologize for forgetting the answer to it. When you were putting together the proposal, Mr. Buchholz, to do this core system replacement, and we were talking about it in this committee and in other places, this was not, to my recollection, specifically part of the package, or was it? And I missed it in the detail because it wasn't specifically a capital expense, it was an ongoing operational expense.
Madam Chair, I don't know that we talked about this specific piece. This is an add-on option in Gentax. We were talking, I think, just about the core system itself. Excuse me, I don't know that we talked about the add-on option.
Was it something that you all had discussed with FAST for when you were in the process of developing the plan to do the core system replacement?
Chair Steiner Hayward, yes, we did talk with them, because if we are granted this policy option package, it's an easy plug into the module that they already have in their core system. We had, at the time that we were also doing this, doing the pilots. If you'll recall, Mr. Ross talked about the pilots with LexisNexis, mm-hmm. and also with Arm Insight, I think was the other firm that we had done some work with. And we did that work in order to determine was this a good package for us to buy? But it wasn't part of the core, although it's an easy plug to have access to the data and then run it through their analytic tools inside the core system replacement project.
Okay, Senator Woodsit.
If you could go back to the core system replacement for a minute. If this fraud analytical system is going to cost $375,000 a year to have, which may be a good investment, what is the overall ongoing cost of the core system?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, I believe Mr. Smith has quoted that it will be about $8 million a biennium. Is that the figure he's used,
it's
Jim?
In that ballpark. We can get it for you more exactly.
Yeah.
That would be good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And as a reminder for the committee, it would be helpful to give us a comparator about what you think you're roughly spending maintaining your legacy systems and things like that.
Okay.
And maybe some guesstimate about time lost or something. I mean, it's just like, when you hear that number, $8 million a biennium, it sounds like a lot of money, especially when you add on another million for this. So it's really more like $9 million. In ongoing operational costs. I understand these things are expensive, and we also understand that there's a really good reason to go with this one because it's grown and maintained and you benefit from the collaborative of the other states. We get all that, mm-hmm. but it's a helpful reminder about what it would be costing to maintain the legacy systems. Senator Woodson.
Further question comes to mind. If it's going to cost about $4 million a year to maintain this core system, are you going to have additional costs from DAS on the server, are you going to have, and what's that going to be?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, I don't know that number off the top of my head, but we would have ongoing costs for the increased capacity from the system, and we can try to get that for you. We pay a base cost to the data center now. We'll have to see what the delta is between the new core system replacement and what we're currently paying the data center to see if we can determine what the increased cost is.
What are you currently paying the data center?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, I don't have our base cost for. I know what we're paying for the project right now, which is, I want to be careful because I don't. It's about, let me get back to my slide. For the project itself to ETS, I happen to have that number right here.
$4 million-ish.
And that's also, Madam Chair, today's price. That's subject to instantaneous change, and it's never down.
It's just over $2 million in the policy option package for the data center costs for core system replacement specifically. That's we also have base costs, of course, for our ongoing programs.
It would be really good to have that all on one sheet as to what your, you know, the ongoing cost to the COTS vendor and then what your cost will be.
Okay.
And also, if I may, the 33 FTE, those are not temporary, so are we assuming that when you have it up and running, you're going to continue to pay those 33
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, they are actually just specifically for the project right now, those 33 positions. There will be some number that we will need to help maintain the system going forward, but I don't have that number right now.
How many do you have currently maintaining your system?
Right now, excuse me, Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Woodsit, we have 69 staff in our IT department right now.
That's got to be expensive. Okay, Representative Comp.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. For clarification, because when Senator Woodsit asked his first question, I got lost. And so that I'm checking for understanding here, so then we have $8 million a year that we're going to be paying for a system to do, to have all this work, and plus, it really got complicated. 33 staff members, Are they new?
No. Let me see if I can articulate it. Because
thank you.
And then you guys tell me if I'm wrong, because if I say it out loud and I'm right, then it means that I actually finally get this.
I'm trying.
Yeah, I know. Well, this is all brand new to you because you weren't on the subcommittee for the past 3 years, and I came in toward the beginning of all this and had to catch up fast. The 33 currently, let's take the current situation. We've just been told there are 69 staffers solely devoted to maintaining their legacy systems and keeping those running. Okay? 69 full-time staff doing that, maintaining those systems, and an ETS charge for those systems that we don't know what it is, but they're going to get us.
Yes,
right? That's our current situation. And there's a cost associated with those 69 workers, and you're going to give us what that biennial cost
sure.
is, please, as part of that. So that's where we are right this very minute. On top of the tough to evaluate costs of opportunity opportunity costs, essentially in terms of the time lost for regular workers who can't get to things and all that kind of stuff that we're talking about, and taxpayer frustration. But that we can't really measure very easily. So right now we're in the process of funding the replacement of almost all, two-thirds of those legacy systems, at a net cost, including debt service and everything else, of about $80 million, right, over many years. The project itself is not taking many years. The project itself is taking about 3 years, all told. And once that project, and those are, there are 33 people who are assigned, and we're funding specifically for working on that project. So far, so good?
Correct.
Okay, good. So those 33 people, first Senator Whitsitt's question, the answer is in it, which is the question, some of those people will have to stay on to maintain this system, but you won't need 69 people to run the system anymore, because really it's going to be mostly FAST that's going to be running the system, and you're going to have some local people here working with them and supporting your workers and doing some ongoing system work. This is where I may be getting lost.
Almost there.
Okay, good.
So the 33 positions that we have dedicated to the core system replacement project are a combination of business representatives that are in helping us make sure that as we bring the programs up, we have the right rules in place as we configure the system. About 11 or 12 of those are actually technical staff working on the system, helping with the configuration and learning that as we go forward. And then the remainder of those are in the project management side of the office.
Okay.
So not all 33 positions are technical based.
Right.
A component of those are, and what we don't know is of that component that's got the technical base, what might be necessary moving forward, because they are the ones that are learning how to configure the system, support the system, do production support, that kind of thing, as well as staff back at the office. That's what we don't know yet.
And we also don't know what's going to happen with those 69 people who are currently maintaining the legacy system. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Chair Steiner Hayward, what you have to remember is the technical people that are on the project came out of the 69 positions
okay.
that are in our IT services area. So they are current staff in our base program that are learning the new system, and then some component of them will go back to continue to support the system, and then we'll have to look at what is necessary to support the remainder of the legacy systems.
Okay.
Senator Whitsitt, do you have a question?
I certainly do.
Senator Whitsitt.
If a preponderance of those 33 people are current staff, what do you need $26 million for?
Chair Steiner.
Already being paid.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Whitsitt, what we have done in order to support this project is move them full-time to bond funding so that they can work on the project specifically. That funding is used to pay for the positions on the project. The money that is where they were at in the program has been used to backfill those positions so we can keep the production levels up inside of our organization.
Okay, so I guess the bottom line, that makes sense. You're going to have to keep your legacy system going until you replace it.
Right.
And so that should incrementally wind down.
Right.
So I guess the question that I think the committee should know is, right now you have 69 people in IT, and an additional 33 is 102 people, what you're going to start out with. When you get finished, when it's done, How many people are you going to have running an IT?
Chair Steiner Hayward, that is the question we are going to try to answer for you. We will have 69.
I think that's an answer we have to have.
Right. I understand what you're asking me. It's 69 base positions in ITS. How many of them will be dedicated to the core system replacement project for the long-term maintenance and support? We have yet to figure out. I don't have that answer off the top of my head.
And the other part of that question is, how many do you think you'll need to keep maintaining the remaining one-third of your legacy systems that you're not replacing?
Right.
Yes. So share with us really quickly, when would you anticipate being able to get us that information?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Smith. So we will do our best to give you an estimate right now. We are still learning, right, as we go through this project. We don't know all of our needs, but the 17-19 biennium is the closeout of the project and will be the go-forward strategy for the project. We will have a much better sense when we come back to you in 2 years, but I can give you an estimate, I believe, at this time for what we think that might be going forward.
All right, thank you.
If I may, Mr. Pritchard, Representative Comp, how are you doing? I was sort of explicating, I think, while you were out of the room. I apologize. How are you doing so far?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
But the point that I'm going to ask is, so this whole project is $80 million. And since this first time I'm on this committee, this project, I guess I would like to know when this project started, and I think I just heard a date when there's the expected completion. And this $80 million, was that funded through bonding, general fund, or how was that?
So who would like how to answer
are we,
that
Yeah,
question?
How are we paying for that?
And I apologize. We've been playing musical chairs here, so I apologize. Who would like to answer this question?
That's okay. If we can go back to the slide, Jim, if you can go back. So Chair Steiner Hayward, Representative Comp, if you look at this chart and you look at the far right-hand column, that is a combination of costs we incurred. If you look at the roughly $8 million in planning for 2009 through 13 was $7.3 million. That was used to plan for the project, to develop the business case, to do all of the project plans that were necessary, to go through LFO review, all that kind of stuff. We actually got funding to implement the project starting the current biennium, 2013-2015, and that's where we brought project staff on board, got the vendor on board, and have actually been incurring costs. The component that you see in the middle there that says other fund bonds, that is what is being funded by 11Q general obligation bonds. The remainder of that is general fund component. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, it does, now that I'm on the right slide.
Okay. Fair enough.
I'm not sure.
At this point, Co-Chair Smith is chairing, so he's got the gavel.
Okay. I'm sorry.
That's
my apologies.
Perfectly fine. We confuse folks. Or the chair
we swap back and forth on a pretty regular basis, but Senator Whitson.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Chris. I may have misunderstood you, but I thought that you said the primary cost of the $26.3 million was the 33 employees.
Chair Smith, Senator Whitsett, that is correct.
That's $800,000 per employee.
Remember also there's vendor costs in there for the software itself. We have deliverables.
Well, let's break that down and find out what it is, because we're not paying these employees $400,000 a piece a year, so let's find out what it is.
And I have that breakdown for you, and
happy to
get it for you.
I would have applied for one of those jobs.
You and me both. So it's actually not all employee costs.
Correct. There's vendor costs in there as well.
Okay, because that was the question.
The director.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, may I add something? Representative Comp and Senator Whitsitt, you way back, about 10 minutes ago, asked a question about the $4 million a year, the $8 million a biennium. And I think one of the things that might make that a little bit easier to swallow is that cost includes, or included in that cost, is upgrades. So there's FAST has a minor upgrade every 18 months and a major upgrade every 36 months. So what that means is that by paying that, we'll never have to go through another multi-year $80 million project. We'll be paying for those upgrades, and we'll always maintain a state-of-the-art system. So we're not paying for this system that will wind up being 20 years old again, like the system that we've got now.
Senator Johnson?
No, I'm sorry,
Senator Whitson. Jim, I don't have a problem with $4 million a year. I just want to know what else. I mean, if you're going to spend $4 million a year, then how many, are there, is going to be a savings in FTE or an increase in FTE? What else as it goes along? Obviously, the $26.3 million is, there's also a lot of other expenses put in that aren't labor. So let's just find out and a complete...
Get your breakdown.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, gotcha.
Senator Johnson.
I was late, and I don't know whether or not you covered this, but back up on the slides where you're talking about analytics, you had Thomson Reuters.
Mm-hmm. I did.
I'm curious about the analytics piece and how that fits in. And in the interest of full disclosure, there are other vendors cruising the halls right now that are interested in having their systems considered. I'm trying to understand why analytics weren't considered in the first iteration of the package. It seems to me a pretty material element, especially given the boo-boo that happened a while ago with the return that got passed. Why did the analytics become an up and extra? What is it that's unique about this system that you prefer over other available operating systems that do these kind of analytics? And whether or not this was anticipated in the core cost that we've already paid for to be phased in later.
Chair Smith and Senator Johnson, let me take a stab at it, and then Jim will probably correct me when I get it wrong, right? So the core system includes an analytics package. It's called KXEN, and it's a SAP product. And so
I don't understand a SAP
product. SAP is the vendor. I don't know what
SAP.
SAP, have you heard? That's a well-known vendor in the analytics community, just like SAS would be as well. They're on par in that component. So when you hear other vendors pitching you analytics products, Gentax, our software, has it built in. They use the engines KXEN. It's a data analytics tool. We bought that. We have that. The fraud analytics package that we're asking for is to buy big data from Thomson Reuters and run it through the analytics tool. So the $750,000 is to purchase data. It is not actually to purchase a data analytics tool. It's built into the system already.
Follow up?
Yeah, please.
Just to make sure that I get this. Did your analytics come with the system, or was it an add-on? And if it was an add-on, did somebody make the considered choice that product A was better than product B?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, it is not an add-on. It's integrated in the system, and so it comes with it. There wasn't a choice. We didn't say we like one vendor better than another vendor, so we want you to use that analytics tool. This one is integrated, so it's best used with the Gentax product.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I might add, too, that the reason why you didn't hear much about this when we first started the journey to replace the system is because this is new with version 9 of the system. Part of what FAST does is they are continually upgrading their system and adding the things that the states demand of them. And one of the things that the states demanded of FAST is that they integrate a predictive analytics engine into the system. And that this is brand new with the latest upgrade.
Mr. Chair, please. Just a comment. I think there's a cautionary tale for all of us in these huge computer systems. And to speak to Representative Comp's question, this computer upgrade got worked like a dog with an old bone. This was not just the committee walked in and said, let's do this. There were several biennia of grinding on it before the go-no-go decision was finally made. And I think for 90 amateurs or generalists in this building to then begin monkeying around with additional components for these computer systems is incredibly dangerous given our hideous track record with IT. And so far, you guys are not in the hideous column, but you have been about ground on until the whole agency's a white powder before we let them go forward. This project has probably received more scrutiny, more antagonistic questions from the General Gov sub than any other computer project, and as a result of legislative oversight, you guys at this point are performing. And I think that tells a cautionary tale.
Representative Comp, did you have a question?
No. Senator Johnson, really, her voice speaks volumes to me and about the history on this project because of other projects that I've also been involved in. I get very, very cautious quickly. But thank you.
So, let me ask a few questions. And again, I apologize. I came in late as well. What type of return do we anticipate should this package get funded? It's a $750,000 general fund request. What type of return will we save? What savings will be had? What's our anticipated savings?
Mr. Chair, that's a difficult question to answer. And the reason it's difficult is because you're asking me to identify those refunds that we're sending out now that we don't know about. Mm-hmm. We don't know. We can't tell you. We think that we're sending out refunds that we ought not to be. And some of them we've identified.
Right.
We think that there's quite likely other refunds that we're sending out that we haven't caught, but we don't know what we don't know. And the other thing that is probably important is to look at the slope of the attempts, which is increasing exponentially. So even if I were able to identify a dollar amount for you now, mm-hmm. you could probably at least 150% that for next biennium and beyond.
Okay.
So it's a difficult question to answer what we don't know.
That's fair. If I understood correctly, this request, we're buying data to put into the system. What's the estimated useful life of that data? How long is it going to remain current?
Representative Smith, so the request is for an ongoing purchase of the data. So as Thomson Reuters continues to accumulate data on all of us, that data will be the most up-to-date information that runs through the system.
Will we be anticipating every biennium?
Yes.
Building this into future budgets?
Yes.
And additional expense?
Yes.
Will it be $750,000-ish per biennium?
Based on what I know today, that would be a good estimate.
Okay, so then should the co-chairs decide they want to go down this path, and should this committee concur and go down that path, in 2 years, are we going to be able to step back and see what the return was on our 750? How are we going to measure to know this is a good ongoing investment?
Mr. Chair, that's a good question, and I would expect that we would be able to. We should be able to identify the difference between what we caught with the Thomson Reuters data based on what we would have caught with our old business rules.
So
we should be able to get that.
So John, is that something that we can just think about in the future of trying to look at that in 24 months to see how this worked out?
Co-chair, absolutely. And just to note for the record, on the advice of Ken Rocco, the Legislative Revenue Office is also looking at this package independently for a potential revenue impact. So that is another correlation that the subcommittee may have by the time they come to consider this package.
Got it. Good to know.
Okay. He asked my question better than I did, because that's basically what I was asking,
yeah.
but he
okay.
asked it better
okay,
than
fair.
I did.
Right. Any other questions or comments?
Yeah.
All right, let's proceed.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Senator Whitsitt.
Just going back to the bar graph you have on fraud analytics and detection. Have you upgraded your ability to detect fraud during those 4 or 5 years, or is that just are you using the same analytical? I mean, is it a combination of better detection and more fraud, or just the same thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witz, I think you hit it. It's a combination of both. Part of what we do is we partner with all of the other states across the nation that have an income tax, and we share information with them. And we share information not only about current things, but things that they see, that folks see coming down the pike. And so, yes, the business rules have been continually refined, and in fact, they get refined every year. We add additional bank accounts that are questionable. We add just numerous different things that folks are seeing as particular patterns.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you go to slide 8, please? There you go. Thank you. The second component of this policy option package for fraud is to partner with the Employment Department to change the quarterly withholding report to gather information on behalf of each employee and then have that report modified and sent back to the Oregon Department of Revenue. The Employment Department is the owner of the quarterly payroll report, so the $361,204 here is for us to ask them to reprogram their system to add this column of data that would be necessary so that we could then go back, and as we are bringing up Gentax, we would configure our system to match against that data that comes in from the Employment Department. So we would anticipate that employers would start reporting this information in 2016, and then tax processing year 2017, which is based on tax year 2016, kind of crazy for my head, would have the employee data that then we could do the real-time withholding match against. Pretty straightforward.
Senator Witson, then we'll go back.
Yeah, thank you. That's a one-time expense.
Chair Smith, Senator Witson, yes.
And how will the Employment Department benefit from having that ability to interact with you?
Mr. Chair, Senator Witson, I don't think the Employment Department would benefit from this information. They're getting all of the information that they need for their particular purposes. This would be something that we would ask them to gather while they're gathering the other data for our purposes. I don't think they benefit from it.
Thank you.
Before we move off the slide, I have a 101 question.
Okay.
It's going to be a very naive question, but hang with me. How do we benefit from this? Tell me, what are you going to use this data for?
Mr. Chair, currently, we begin processing our income tax returns in January as people file. The information returns, the W-2 and 1099 information, including the withholding information, isn't due from employers until, is it March?
March.
End of March. And so we don't have an ability right now to match up what the taxpayer is claiming on their return as withholding and what they've actually paid. And so what we're asking is to add another column that gives Oregon wages and Oregon withholding in the withholding report so that we can use that. We'll have that data as they filed it in January 31st is when that last quarter is due, but we'll be able to use the three quarters of data that we have gotten in prior to be able to interpolate numbers to make sure that the dollar amount that they're asking for in withholding is in the ballpark.
So will this matching up occur electronically, or will it be a manual checking?
Mr. Chair, it'll be electronic, and that's what the $361,000 is paying for. No, excuse me. That's the $361,000 is the employment part. We will build it into our system, but it would be an easy thing to build in.
And so, the computer in computer land will cross-reference these and match them up.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, and we'll be able to kick out anomalies and look at them.
Perfect. That makes some sense to me. Madam Co-Chair, did you have a question?
No, I didn't. I thought Sarah Representative Comp did, so I was waving in her direction, but I was wrong.
Okay.
Next slide. So the first of three policy option packages for the Property Tax Division is related to the Accounting Assessment Function Funding Assistance program funds, which are for the industrial valuation program. So I'm going to refer to them going forward as CAFA because the other is too hard of a mouthful for me to carry on a regular basis.
But oh, we've got a question here. Representative Comp.
I'm sorry, but I don't have a clue what CAFA is, and I didn't catch it as you said it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, CAFA stands for the County Assessment Function Funding Assistance. And what it is it's a certain dollar amount on every recording, and a certain percentage of the delinquent interest for delinquent property taxes goes into a fund that helps the county assessors and the Department of Revenue fund the assessment and taxation system, the property tax system.
Thank you. Comment, Mr. Co-Chair?
Yes.
If I stay in this building long enough, I literally am going to try to pass a bill that there is a glossary seriously, for every committee.
That'd be a great idea.
Well,
we don't need a bill. We'll just all of us co-chairs will have a revolt and we'll insist on them.
Well, it's
probably be the size of the ORSs behind you.
Well, it's really. As we move through this process, and I've been here 11 years, to have a feeling of total inadequacy right. when I'm hearing a presentation is a little humbling, to say the least.
I would just share as a little history. It makes perfect sense to say CAFA, so I get that. Okay?
Well, and I'm sure it does.
Yeah. Representative Butler, years ago, used to have a little piggy bank that would sit there.
Senator Winters did, too.
And if you ever used an acronym, you were plunking cash into the piggy bank, and then at the end, I believe she donated it to the food bank or something like that. But in all fairness, going through CAFA and saying it fully would be
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the grace.
Yeah.
So this policy option package requests an additional $1,836,836 of general fund to replace the difference between what are the allowable CAFA receipts that the department can use for administration of the industrial valuation programs and what the current staffing costs are projected to be. So the red line represents what the staffing costs are projected to be, have been and or projected to be, and the blue line represents the 10% of ALAWA CAFA receipts that the department can use for administration of the industrial valuation programs. Obviously, there's been a gap, and as Senator Johnson pointed out in phase one, the gap's been going on for a long time, and this is the first you're hearing about the gap from a request in the budget. The LFO office and CFO office worked with us in the interim on some of our other fund issues inside the organization to help bring these forward for consideration this session. So the gap represents 10 positions that we would like to shift that are currently identified as other funds onto general funds. So the impact is about 10 positions inside the property tax division's valuation program. So the driver in the staffing costs is, generally speaking, cost of living increases and step increases over time. The staffing level has remained relatively constant, as Mr. Kinslow pointed out, and the CAFA receipts have remained relatively flat. So that is what is creating this gap going forward. If the policy option package isn't funded, again, it will impact 10 positions in the division. And it's hard to quantify what that impact may be. As you know, the valuation program is responsible for ensuring that all industrial properties are valued at 100% of real market value. And over time, this may erode as we have less staff available to do that work.
You say impact, you're talking about eliminating positions.
Chair Smith, yes, because the 10 positions that we are requesting the change in funding, if they don't, there's not enough money in the CAFA program to support them going forward.
So do you see this trend continuing? Is this just a reality that we have to deal with, or is there an opportunity to return back to 2001?
Chair Smith, I believe that generally speaking, going forward, the gap will continue to grow because staffing costs will probably continue to outpace the allowable CAFA receipts inside the department. unless there is a change to the CAFA formula itself.
Got it. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Co-Chair Smith. So what does that blue line tell us about our economy? If that's 10% of the receipts that you're getting for industrial assessment, does that mean that we're having a lot less industrial growth? I mean, I can see that in 2007, 2008, there was a drop-off there, which coincides with the recession. But supposedly, we're not in a recession now.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the blue line is made up of two components. It's a dollar amount recording fee for every recording. It's a recording fee, and it's a percentage of the interest on delinquent property taxes. So that doesn't really relate to the workload, the amount of industrial accounts that we have to appraise. It goes to the amount of delinquent interest and the recording. So you might imagine that prior to the housing bubble, when there was a lot of turnover real estate, the recording fee was pretty high. There was a lot of activity in refinance too, as the interest rates first started to go down, and so that helped prop the dollar amount for the CAFA up. The other side was true too, in reverse. As the economy tanked, the taxpayers had less of an ability to pay their property taxes, and so the delinquent property taxes grew, and the interest on the delinquent interest grew during that period. So there's a couple of different things going on, and they roughly offset each other over the last 8 years or so.
Could we see a graph that gives us the previous 10 years?
Prior to 2001? I think we can get that, yes.
Thank you.
Although, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, the base changed in 1999. It was the recording fee was $20 a recording. Yes, $20 a recording back in 1989 when it first came in, and it was on a narrower base of recordings. They broadened the base and lowered the fee. They lowered the fee to $11. And then they also, in I think it was either 97 or 99, added a second tier of interest to the CAF account. It used to be that everybody paid 25%. They added a what they call two-tier interest onto that, where certain taxing districts pay an additional amount. And so it might be a little bit difficult for you to follow once it hit 99. But we have the data. We can get it for you.
Okay. The next policy option package on slide 10 is for the Senior and Disabled Citizens Property Tax Deferral Program. Over the last 4 years, there has been changes to this program every session. And at the time the changes were occurring, no fiscal impacts were identified. However, the cumulative effect of the changes has required the department to borrow staff internally during their processing season to meet the program needs. The changes to the program over the course of the 4 years include the following. The time to review and process applications has increased significantly. Prior to 2011, eligibility was based on age and adjusted gross income. Now staff need to take a look at residency, insurance, net worth, reverse mortgages, and the real market value of the home. In addition, there are caps on the number of new applications now that may be accepted. Excuse me.
I apologize. Senator Johnson.
Are you an information aggregator or are you the originator of the information? If I'm applying for the program, do I just send you my material or are you out doing independent analysis of whether or not my statement of net worth is accurate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we don't audit these. It's essentially just gathering the information that the claimants send in.
Okay.
So we're information receivers.
Does it come in some specified form, or in some cases do they just send you a shoebox full of stuff and say, go figure it out?
Chair Smith, Senator Johnson, yes. Remember, these are older or disabled people who...
Careful, you're talking to an old lady with a cane.
who have limited means and in many cases struggle to even pull all the paperwork together, you know, a copy of their insurance, you know, the front page of their insurance policy, their income, their property tax statement. They have to pull all of that information together.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, we do supply a form for them to fill out for the recertification.
Is there a simpler way to do this? What I'm trying to figure out is, instead of paying state people to do it, could you partner with senior centers the same way I'm thinking of the SHIBA program? And again, Representative Comp, I apologize. I don't remember what SHIBA stands for. I know what they do, but I don't know what it means. But that was really quite successful in having community people that are reliable folks for an older person to give this private data to. Is that a model you could utilize and maybe reduce some of these needs for staff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, I don't think it's anything we've explored, but it certainly is worth at least toe-dipping to find out if it's a viable option.
Senator Whitsett.
Yeah, two quick questions. How many people do you currently have working in the Senior Disability Citizens Property Tax Deferral Division? And two, what is the total handle today, you know, on the property tax deferral? How many million dollars are you handling?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, we better get that for you, both of those. The staff, it's very small. It's in the 3 to 5 range, but we'll need to get an exact number for you. And I know that the dollar amount that we send out each year for payment in property taxes is somewhere in the $20 million range, but we can get you that.
Our trusty encyclopedia, John, is telling us 8 employees. He's telling us 8 employees.
Eight employees. I think
6.5 FTE. Pardon me.
Yeah. Okay, 6.5
FTE. 6.5 FTE.
Right,
is
they're combined with the timber unit, and that's why I was hesitating.
Again, I have a 101 question. Is there a qualification to be eligible for this program?
Chair Smith, yes. Your age, adjusted gross income, insurance.
But I heard that, well, we don't audit. So how are we verifying that?
We're accepting the information that the applicants send in.
What's that?
We are accepting the information that the applicants send in.
Oh.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
You may have said this, or Senator Whitsett just asked you, how many souls are beneficiaries of this program?
Is it over 6,000? Because we're recertifying 3,000 a year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Johnson, it's a little bit higher than 6,000. It's 6,000 to 7,000 currently. Up at its peak, it had gotten to 10,000. But prior, subsequent to the changes that the legislature made, the participation rate has dropped. Again, that's something that we can get for you exactly.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Smith. So what is the adjusted gross income? What is the cutoff?
Yeah.
What does it have to be, approximately?
Chair Smith, I don't have that off the top of my head, but we can certainly get it for you.
Follow up?
Please.
Thank you, Chair Smith. But it would be connected to most likely to what they're getting from Social Security or the disability insurance. I mean, their disability, right? Check from the state, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, it's total household income. It includes taxable and non-taxable sources.
Mm-hmm. Follow up? Thank you, Chair Smith. So there could be a risk of a person receiving this benefit that's a senior that is on mainly getting their income, one person getting their income. Does you have to be married, or is it just the single person that can file for this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, I believe it's household income, and it's irrespective of whether you're married or not.
Okay.
And if I may, to follow up on the underlying question that you've got, Mr. Chair, about whether or not we're auditing them, remember that the amounts that the state pays in these property taxes goes again as a lien against the property.
So we're going to get it.
The lien accumulates interest at 6% simple throughout the years. And so when there's a disqualifying event and the person goes out of the program, the dollars get repaid into the program, and those become available for other seniors to take advantage of.
How does that work? Is the home liquidated? How do we get the property taxes back?
Mr. Chair, in some cases the heirs pay them. In some cases the heirs sell the property that they've inherited.
But there's an encumbrance on the deed.
Yes, yes.
Just so I'm clear on this, and I apologize, Kimmy, I just want to make sure. So even if someone is not technically eligible, should they apply, we're going to capture it on the back.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And I guess with it 6%, I mean, that's pretty expensive.
Mr. Chair, the risk of not auditing would be that the dollar amount in the fund became so low that somebody else that was more deserving wasn't able to participate of that. But there's enough money in the fund that everybody that is applying for it is able to participate.
I see. Representative Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, because I'm kind of one of those old people, and I have a lot of those old people in my district. Had an example this past year. Mother passed away, daughter's in California. She had used this opportunity to keep her heat on and these types of things, but she didn't struggle with anything until she ended up dealing with the bank that held the mortgage. Mm-hmm. And it took 6 months for us, you know, working with several different agencies and lobbyists for the bankers to make it possible for her to sell this home. And it was really a convoluted mess. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't because of this issue, but it was part of that, and getting all those details, and it was really hard. She lost 3 different sales to the home while she was trying to get all this figured out. Mm-hmm. And it's challenging, very challenging when you do this. And I learned a lot about this kind of situations.
Please continue.
So just to wrap this one up, the package is requesting 7 positions, 4 FTE. So we'd have 6 seasonal positions for the processing season, and $497,179 to support those 7 positions. And it would come out of the revolving account that Jim described as the liens go in, that kind of thing.
The season, is that November to what's the season?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, it's in the spring.
It's in the spring.
Right.
For property taxes.
Mr. Chair, this is our season for processing the application. I believe that the applications are due by April 15th, mm-hmm. and then we have a couple of months to certify, and then we tell the counties in November how much we're paying.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
The next is a request for a property valuation program inside the property tax division. Currently, the property valuation system is a conglomeration of Excel spreadsheets, paper files, and databases that manage over $45 billion worth of assets between the industrial program and the central assessment program. And as you can imagine, there is no integration of the data or information. The ability to do data analysis is very limited because of the types of files and information that it sits on, and there is no stability long-term for this system. And I use that in quotes because I'm not sure spreadsheets, paper files, and databases equate to an actual system. So we are requesting, if you go to the next slide, Jim, please, to address the issues inside the valuation program by purchasing a commercial off-the-shelf computer-assisted mass appraisal software package. So each of the counties right now has a similar package. There are vendors in the vendor community that have this type of software. And the bullet points that you see up here are the things that we would achieve or benefit from in having this commercial off-the-shelf CAMA, as it's called, computer-assisted mass appraisal software, including integrating appraisal technology for the programs that's not integrated now, employing industry standards in one product across the appraisal program, greatly improving customer service. As you can imagine, the large companies that we value or assess are frustrated with us that we ask them to either send it to us in paper or on an Excel spreadsheet now.
So would this information be public record, subject to public record request?
Mr. Chair, no, it's confidential.
It's confidential. So in the county level, many counties have it online, mm-hmm. to where you can go look at real property.
Mr. Chair, the confidential part is the information about the assets and the income of the companies. The value, once we derive a value and send that to the county and it gets published as part of the assessment roll, then it becomes public information. Just the value.
So here's where I'm going with this. So could a banker contact you folks and say, I'd like the value of XYZ piece of property, and be able to obtain that from the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, yes, we could give them our final value. We'd most likely direct them to the county to get it, because the county is the one that owns that after we've done our work.
Same information.
Yes, right. Well, we do our work, and then we send it to the counties, and the county folds that into their other assessment role to generate the tax bills.
Perfect sense. Okay, mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Thank you. I apologize. And just to clarify something you said, this system that you're proposing to purchase would have interoperability with the ones that the counties currently have, so it would be easy to export data from yours into theirs? Is that the expectation?
Chair Smith, Senator Steiner. Excuse me, Senator Steiner Hayward, that would be one of the goals of the system, yes.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Please.
There are approximately 4 or 5 different software systems that the counties use now.
Mm-hmm.
And so if it's compatible with the particular system, then yes, we would be able to exchange data, but we wouldn't be able to exchange data with all 36 counties, because not all 36 counties are on the same platform.
Mr. Chair, may I have a follow-up?
Of course.
So I'm having total PTSD about electronic health records here, because this sounds just like the problem that we have with electronic health records. There are a gazillion vendors of electronic mm-hmm. health record systems, and you cannot transfer information from one to another. At this point, if they're on the same platform, I can see it, mm-hmm. but I can't import it, which are two entirely different things. Seeing it is basically just looking like a right. piece of paper. Importing it means I can actually compare their lab values to the lab values I'm getting, right?
Yes.
And so if there isn't interoperability, you're basically just going to be sending them a disk, and they're going to have to turn around, or a flash drive or something, and they're going to have to be turning around and entering all that information by hand?
Mr. Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, the method that we use to transmit the values to the counties is all uniform. The method that we use to transmit the values, once we derive the values or come up with the values for the industrial and the centrally assessed properties, the method that we use to transmit those values to the counties is all uniform. They take it in, they have their own software system. There's 4 or 5 different software systems that they incorporate those values in to generate the property tax bills.
So in essence, it's sort of like saying, okay, you can export an address book into a comma separated values file and then import it into a lot of different other contact systems, whether it's Outlook or the Mac OS or whatever. You're going to send it to them in a way that they can import it, or if there's isn't capable, then it's their problem to figure out how to enter it.
I don't know.
Mr. Chair, I don't possess that technology gene, so you just lost.
Well, I do, which is why. All right. So the net answer is,
yeah,
there's not going to be a clean way necessarily for you to export your derived values to the county systems for them to assess the tax.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stanner Hayward, yes, we will be able to cleanly submit our values to the counties. Okay. What I'm talking about is the ability of the county, the different counties, to talk to each other.
No, that's not what I'm saying. Get the there's not going to be necessarily a clean way for you to get the information directly into the county systems at this point. Right now, just to go back to the electronic health records for a moment. Mm-hmm. Right now, if I have one of my patients at OHSU seeing a subspecialist who's also at OHSU but in an entirely different practice than mine, right? He writes a note and uploads it to the system and CCs it to me, and it's automatically entered into the same electronic health record, so it's all one system, right?
Right.
And there are even systems where there are labs outside of this, of OHSU, that directly transmit information into our electronic health record system because there's a bridge, right, that says here's how we translate the data from here into the data from there and just get it into the system. What I'm asking is there going to be something like that, or you're going to transmit a clean set of values however you do it, and it's going to be their problem to figure it out?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stanner Hayward, there are, and I hope I'm answering your question, there are software data standards that that the counties require us to submit this information to them, to that it meets. And so no matter what, they are going to be able to take the values. I'm not answering your question.
That's okay. I think you are. I think you're saying it's the CSV analogy, and I'm good then. It's fine. So that's fine.
Representative.
Thank you, Chair Smith. So do all the counties have this, have some sort of software currently, do you, to your knowledge?
Chair Smith, Representative Taylor, that's my understanding.
Okay, follow up. Then do each, so can you derive the information from the counties and bring, if you wanted to find something out going on in the counties and run some sort of query or something like that, would you be able to do that at the state level in your office from the counties?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, yes. And no.
Okay.
Yes, in that they are required to submit their information, the summary of assessment and levy information, to us every year. Because there are different platforms, and there are different sophistication levels out in the counties. We have, I would say, our research department would say we have varying degrees of success in how easily we're able to integrate all of that data together.
Okay, follow up. So the reason I'm bringing this up is that, as you know, I've been, Senator Whitsett and I have been working with your office on collections, and bottom line, we'd like to have the revenue that's owed to the state to come to the state. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to understand is how all of the systems are talking to each other and how we can detect fraud and detect how people are perhaps hiding assets.
Right. Sure.
And it concerns me if we have property valued throughout the state and somebody could own a piece of property and owe the state money, and they have something that we could be putting a lien on or something that we could be demanding that they pay us, but how are we going to know if these systems are not talking to each other?
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, that is part of our process to do what we call skip tracing. Skip tracing isn't just trying to find individuals, but it's also trying to find assets that we can attach if a taxpayer owns a debt.
Okay, follow up. So will you be able to skip trace and find out who owns property? So in Grants Pass, if somebody owes, you know, $13,000 in some form, I don't care what the form is, a business tax, a personal income tax, property tax, whatever it is that they owe that is due to the state, will we be able to work with the counties and figure out that they have an asset and they, in essence, are able to pay us? They may not want to pay the money owed to the state, but they have the ability to pay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Taylor, yes, we do do that.
You do
we
do that.
We do do that now.
Okay. Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. So we have 7 minutes, 8 minutes. I'm going to hold my questions, colleagues, and I'm going to ask folks to hold their questions, and we can visit with the director afterwards. So I'm going to ask you to really zip through as quick as you can.
You bet. So to wrap this up, the total request over the life of the project is $3.3 million. The software is roughly $1.5. We are requesting 3 staff to support the valuation system, and of course there would be some hardware purchasing and then the quality assurance necessary for a project of this size. If the program is supported, we would do an RFP this summer, and by spring next year the whole timeline would revise based on the vendor selected, what the plan is going forward. That's just a rough one that you see at the bottom of the page. So the next, I have 2 more policy option packages. This one is House Bill 4055, which is related to the state's 911 emergency communication system. If you'll recall, in the 2014 session, you changed the method of collection of those taxes from a 75 cent per month per subscriber, a prepaid telecommunication, to a 75 cent per transaction starting on October 1st, 2015. We were able to accommodate this change via the core system replacement project and working with all of you on the timing. The department is allowed to use 1% of the revenue generated to support the administration of this program, and we are requesting 2 positions and $339,480 to ensure that we provide taxpayer assistance, collection, return processing, and enforcement due to the increased program volume that we are anticipating. This was outlined in a fiscal impact as the bill passed going forward. The last policy option package that I have is actually, although I don't show it correctly here, is a $2.6 million reduction package that was included in the governor's recommended budget across 3 of our program areas. These were one-time reductions that we identified for vacancy savings, largely due to 2 issues. One, as we gear up programs to go through the rollout, they actually do a little bit of a hiring slowdown in order to focus on the testing, training, and implementation during the rollout. So we won't be filling as quickly behind them because they're in the midst of a rollout. And in addition, for IT, as you have heard probably in many various subcommittees that you're in, currently recruiting for IT professionals is difficult both in the public and the private sector, and we are experiencing that at the Department of Revenue. And while we have changed our recruiting methodologies significantly, we still anticipate vacancies going forward in that arena. The other are S&S reductions, that is, we have looked at historical costs and expenditures we made in the current biennium. We can forego those next biennium. With that, that wraps up the policy option packages. I did have reduction options. I've got the summary here for you. I'm going to do this in a hot second. Each agency is required to do a 10% reduction option by statute. The Department of Revenue does this every 2 years as well. We identified about $21 million in reductions. Our strategy as we do this is to first go to the enforcement staff, largely because 97% of the tax comes in voluntarily, and enforcement is 3% of the pie, if you recall Jim's charts when he did phase 1. And so the impact, as you go to the next slide and you look at the first 5%, is that it does hit our enforcement programs in the personal income tax and business division pretty heavily, and it also has a general fund impact. We anticipate the loss of revenue if you go to audit and collections staff in those reductions. And so for the first 5%, we would anticipate a reduction of costs of $10 million, but a reduction of revenue of potentially over $35 million in general fund. If you go to the next slide, it's the second 5%. Again, it's just over $10 million. We would have a reduction of 67 positions, and it would potentially incur a loss of revenue of almost $30 million. So there are trade-offs in looking at these reduction options going forward. The last five slides of your chart are the bills that had fiscal impacts when they were first dropped at the beginning of the session. Many of these bills, as you can imagine, have not made it through the first chamber or at this point have been amended to the point where the department may not be administering the program anymore. It's shifted to another agency, that type of thing. I don't have specific on all five pages of bills that we have presented to you, but if you have a bill of interest, please let us know and we'd be happy to follow up for you. That concludes my testimony for today, Mr. Chair.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Director, is there any brief comment you want to share with us in closing?
No.
All right. We really, really appreciate all the work you're doing, and you've been asked some tough questions today, and you've handled them very, very well, very professionally. Thank you. All right. Art? You have nothing? Oh, well, I didn't have to rush you. You still have two more minutes to spare. All right.
Almost three.
Colleagues, any questions? Any comments? So just to let folks know, tomorrow it looks like it's going to be a long day on the House floor. And so we're going to just kind of stand at ease in terms of committee schedule for tomorrow. And Madam Co-Chair, as soon as we know what's going on in the House, you know.
Yeah, we'll just stay in touch. I mean, you guys will all be out there, and Co-Chair Smith can tell you what's going on, and I'll keep Senator John, or I will keep Senator Whitson and Senator Johnson apprised.
So that's where we are.
As we say in the trade, semper gumby, always flexible, right?
All righty. John, anything we need to think about?
No.
We're good?
Good.
We're good? All right. Colleagues, we're going to adjourn for the day. All right.